The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, how can we trust the Bible as the Word of God? And even when Christian apologists seek to defend the Bible as being historically accurate, you've heard in school that nothing is truly accurate historically. For the most part, history cannot be trusted. Why? Because history has been written by the victors. Yes, that's another politically correct talking point today. History is written by the victors. I'll respond to this provocative challenge to the accuracy of history and the accuracy of the Bible more specifically later on in today's program. But first, it's been quite a news week. The Republicans had a landslide midterm election last Tuesday night. In his Wednesday press conference, President Obama offered a predictable interpretation of Tuesday's election results. It means Americans want their elected officials to, quote-unquote, work as hard as they do. In other words, the problem is not him, just Washington in general. What the people want is bipartisanship. Of course, long before the election, Obama reminded us that although he himself was not going to be on the ballot in November, his policies were. Evidently, our president has evolved once again. Now he realizes that midterm elections have nothing to do with his policies. Republicans have much to celebrate after a wave bigger than anything the Beach Boys ever dreamed about. But to make the most of this historic opportunity, they would do well to ignore all talking points about working together and realize that they were put in power to stop a president who was out of control. It always sounds so noble to talk about reaching across the aisle. Keep in mind that the sanctimonious unity lecture is embraced by Democrats only when they lose. When they win a majority in the Senate and House of Representatives, it means the people have spoken. It means elections have consequences. It means suck it up, Republicans. But when Democrats are defeated by Republicans, it is never a referendum on Democrats. Instead, it means the people want bipartisanship. Sure, that's what's going on. People placed Republicans in power on Tuesday night not to stop Obama, but to merely get Washington working better on both sides. In reality, they love Obama. After all, they put him in office twice, so they must be very happy with his job performance. The fact that they are now finally tasting his policies a little closer to the pocketbook has nothing to do with it. They haven't stopped to figure out that although the Affordable Health Care Act was passed during Obama's first term, most of it did not go into operation until after his 2012 re-election. They haven't noticed that this maneuver is now starting to smell like nothing more than crafty, crooked, underhanded politics. They aren't bothered that our own president lied about being able to keep your own doctor and health care provider. Neither do his lies about Benghazi concern them, or the IRS scandal, or Fast and Furious. They also admire how he ignores the Constitution and rules by fiat, illegally hiding behind a misused legal function executive order. And of course, the president's reaction to ISIS is not an area of concern. Nobody cares that he rushed to the golf course after offering a few obligatory comments about an American who had just been beheaded. Because of this stellar record, people love Obama and loathe Republicans. Yet somehow, for reasons that don't seem entirely clear, they want the man whom they admire to be held in check by the party they can't stand. Just imagine people stepping into their voting booths saying to themselves, Obama has done a remarkable job, a crackerjack job, and Republicans, well, they're too extreme, as Republicans always are, so what we need is to put more Republicans in office. And that way, the good policies of Obama will be tempered with the bad policies of the Republicans. Does any thinking person really accept this as the true interpretation of Tuesday night? Our new Republican Congress would do well to listen to the people who put them in office instead of losing sleep over how their actions will be viewed the next morning by the New York Times editorial page, or Democratic pollsters, or the president himself. That's not to say Republicans in office should offer nothing to Obama at all. Why not buy him a new set of golf clubs? That way he can have something to do while they run the country. Well, elections aren't the only things that happen in November. In just a few weeks, it will be Thanksgiving, so it's time for our annual public service announcement about proper Thanksgiving etiquette. And who'd here right now to tell you all about it is our own Smiley Miley.
Thanksgiving is just around the corner. And even though the actual holiday is Thursday, we're going to give you Friday off too. When you add in Saturday and Sunday, it will seem like a four-day holiday. But you would have gotten Saturday and Sunday off anyway. So it's really a two-day holiday made out of a one-day holiday. Isn't Thanksgiving fun? Thanksgiving is a different kind of holiday than Christmas. We don't use the word Christmas anymore because the word offends the five people in our country who don't celebrate Christmas. Not so with Thanksgiving. Because no matter what people believe, everybody still loves to eat. So have a great time with your parents around the big dinner table, stuffing your little faces with turkey, pumpkin pie, cranberry sauce, and candied yams. And unlike Christmas, you can even say Happy Thanksgiving to every one of your little playmates. But be careful and make sure you don't tell them who we are being thankful to. Because if you did that, you might have to explain that the first Thanksgiving was made up of pilgrims who were thankful to God. And we don't talk about God anymore because talking about God makes people upset. And it makes them afraid that those who don't believe in God will be arrested and put in jail. That would never happen. But people are still afraid it will happen. And, well, you don't want people to be afraid, do you? Of course not. So don't talk about God unless you want to call him Allah. Then it is okay because people don't worry about being arrested in America for not believing in Allah. They just worry about being arrested in all the other countries if they don't believe in Allah. Now I know what some of you are thinking. What if someone asks me what the first Thanksgiving was all about? How can I explain that without mentioning God? Silly. There are all kinds of things to mention about the first Thanksgiving. You can mention the Mayflower. You can mention the pilgrims, so long as you leave out the part about them coming to America for religious freedom. Because mentioning religious freedom means we will lose our religious freedom. But there's plenty more to talk about. Talk about how wild the original turkeys were. And talk about the Indians who were friendly to the pilgrims. Calling the Indians friendly is always a smart and sensitive thing to do. Only don't use the word Indian. Use the word Native American. Then people will smile at you instead of accusing you of hate speech. Oh, one more thing. If people ask you why Thanksgiving is a holiday, be sure not to tell them that holiday means holy day. Otherwise, you'll have to explain what's holy about it, and we'll be right back where we started. Well, now that you're up to speed on your etiquette and courtesy, Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Thank you. This is Dana Wright, a reoccurring co-host on The Bob Siegel Show. You only need to listen to this radio program once to figure out that Bob has very strong opinions on a wide variety of issues. But one of Bob's strongest passions is freedom of speech itself, even when such speech challenges his own convictions. So feel free to send Bob a comment or a thought-provoking question. You can reach Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
KCBQ 1170, and for all who hear the rebroadcast on KPRZ 1210 sometime in the middle of the night when I myself am sleeping, but you can hear my voice anyway. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Despite the landslide Republican victory on Tuesday night, President Obama does not seem to be budging in his promise to implement immigration reform with or without Congress. At his Wednesday press conference, which debriefed the election results, Obama said, "Before the end of the year, we're going to take whatever lawful actions that I can take. I think it's fair to say that I've shown a lot of patience and tried to work on a bipartisan basis as much as possible and will keep doing so." He has tried to work on a bipartisan basis. How does he say this stuff with a straight face? Look, I don't know what they're paying this guy to be our president, but you got to believe me, it's too much. He continues, "I've consistently said that it is my profound preference and interest to see Congress act on a comprehensive immigration reform bill. What we can't do is just keep on waiting. There's a cost for waiting." No surprises here. He had already said in his June Rose Garden speech, "I have also directed Secretary Johnson and Attorney General Holder to identify additional actions my administration can take on their own within my existing legal authorities to do what Congress refuses to do and fix as much of our immigration system as we can. If Congress will not do their job, at least we can do theirs. I expect their recommendations before the end of summer, and I intend to adopt those recommendations without further delay." All right, now, while some tried to defend President Obama by claiming that other presidents have issued numerous executive orders, others remind us that the amount of executive orders is not the issue, but rather the types of executive orders. Are they really being used constitutionally? Only in the case of an emergency, such as the need for swift military action, or are they part of an agenda? As the debate wages on, perhaps we would do well to stop for a moment and consider the words of a previous president who did not believe he had this much authority. Here's what an earlier president said. "I just have to continue to say this notion that somehow I can just change the laws unilaterally is just not true. We are doing everything we can administratively, but the fact of the matter is there are laws on the books that I have to enforce. And I think there's been a great disservice done to the cause of getting the DREAM Act passed and getting comprehensive immigration passed by perpetrating the notion that somehow, by myself, I can go and do these things. It's just not true." Ladies and gentlemen, this previous president is also President Obama. an older version, evidently, one that existed back in the year 2012 when he explained to a group of immigration reform advocates why he had not done as much about immigration as they might have hoped. This older Obama is in disagreement with our current Obama 5.0. Oh, well, this is the man who claims he has evolved when a position changes. Conveniently, the evolution always tends to give him some kind of political advantage with the base he is trying to impress. Well, if you'd like to weigh in on any of this, you can reach me, of course, on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.net. Olivia on Facebook's like the conversation I had on the radio 2 weeks ago about whether Islam is truly a religion of peace. Velia on Facebook also liked that particular show. Also on Facebook, regarding my advice for our new Republican Congress to not make compromises, the article version posted on my column online, Forbidden Table Talk. Patty, Maureen, and Mary all like what I had to say. Melinda on Facebook says, oh, yes, Bob, you are so correct. Love this article. So perfectly obvious, Bob. Love it. Fran on Facebook says, great editorial, Bob. Sometimes politics just makes me sick to my stomach. We elect these people to do the right thing. There is a right way and a wrong way. Is there any honesty, any true caring for the citizens who are born tired from supporting these politicians who seem to be completely self-serving? You don't have to answer that, brother. Well, thank you for your comment, friend. Tony on Facebook also agrees with my advice for the new Republicans and offers them his own advice. Dominate or be the one dominated. However, Brian, who's a fellow conservative, disagrees with my advice. He says, I disagree, Bob. The majority party should first send legislation, which the Democratic Congress members will embrace. Let the president veto the bills. I'd start with these in this order. 1, build the Keystone Pipeline. 2, secure the border. 3, repeal unpopular parts of Obamacare. Ultimately, it will require a full appeal. 4, overhaul the tax code to have a flatter tax rate and less deductions so that everyone can file their taxes on one page. This one should be big and should be designed to go to the president's desk in the spring of 2016. Tax reform will be wildly popular, and Democratic candidates will be forced to go on the record of supporting it or not. If they do, Rand Paul can take credit for good Republican ideas. If they don't, Rand Paul can use it against Mrs. Rodham Clinton in the general election. Okay, now, Brian, when did I say that we shouldn't pass bills such as those? Those are all issues Republicans have been fighting for quite some time. So if they can get Democrats to go along, that's great. What they must not do is compromise their own convictions. And when Obama does his veto, and he will, they must not soften on him. Also, keep in mind that to Obama and the Democrats, bipartisanship means doing things exactly their way. They know of no other kind of bipartisanship. This fellow on the internet calls himself Sailor Man. He says, we the people elected this Congress to represent us. We the people. And we have spoken. If the new Congress don't take heed, there will be more than the New York Times editorial page to contend with. And Tim says, Congress should offer him impeachment. All the people can offer him is banishment. He won't take the hint. Now, regarding Obama's promise to grant amnesty to millions of illegal aliens and my article version of the monologue you heard in the last segment, Johnny says, this is a bad article. Oh, that hurts, Johnny. That hurts. You know, I was up all night hoping you'd like my article. Johnny continues, first off, the president can indeed pass an executive order temporarily legalizing up to 6 million people, and a vague statement referring to different kinds of executive actions doesn't address why he can't. He has that authority via an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, a principle well established in constitutional law. The chief legal counsel for USCIS, Federal Immigration Agency, has acknowledged that an executive order of this kind would be, oh, you mean somebody who works for Obama said this was legal? That's great, Johnny. Johnny continues. Anyway, this chief legal counsel has acknowledged that an executive order of this kind would be legal and would survive being challenged in court, assuming such a challenge could be presented in the first place. It's complicated, but in general, suing to stop executive orders is hard. He also has the authority via the Constitution itself to pardon immigrants for criminal violations of federal immigration law, although I doubt he will go this far. You are misinforming your viewers and listeners by being intellectually callous. Oh, I'm misinforming people, Johnny? legal hacks such as the one you just quoted or referred to are the ones misinforming people, and they're assuming that people are too stupid to read the Constitution for themselves. The president himself said he did not have such authority, and he was quoted in the very article that you read. But again, more importantly, you know who else says this is illegal? The writers of our Constitution. Where in the Constitution does a president have a right to grant citizenship independent of Congress? Where is the president given permission to ignore the law and choose not to enforce it? I don't care how many legal narcissistic hacks you quote. Show me in the Constitution. Better yet, I'll show you. Article 2, Section 3 directs the president to, quote unquote, take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Obama has not been doing that. And Article 1, Section 8 said it is the job of Congress to naturalize citizens, not the president, Congress. But since you seem to like legal commentary on the Constitution more than the Constitution itself, fine, so be it. Let's look at the Supreme Court. And I'm no fan of the Supreme Court, but evidently, Johnny, these legal minds and talking heads, what they have to say about the Constitution is more important to you. So this is what the Supreme Court said in Fallio versus Bell way back in 1952. Over no conceivable subject is the legislative power of Congress more complete than it is over the admission of aliens. The power to expel or exclude aliens is a fundamental sovereign attribute exercised by the government's political departments, largely immune from judicial control. Freedom, on the other hand, likes my article. He says, Mr. Siegel, that was a great article. Thank you. You hit every single nail right on the head. Yes, the more time old Blamo spends golfing, the safer our country will now be. This new wave of Republican dominance will last beyond the 2016 election only if the Republicans work hard to please the American people during these next 2 years. But if they decide to go back to Rhinoville and do business as usual, then an outraged Republic will make certain that the Democrats will take the 2016 election. The Republicans had best take their current positions as House, Senate, and congressional majority leaders seriously. Playtime is over. And a man who calls himself Captain Hadley says Obama's personal jihad against the Constitution of the United States is destined to fail. We'll be right back. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
Hi, I'm Dana Wright, here to talk about Bob Siegel's book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... The title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but... Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Supposedly, now that Republicans have taken over both the House and the Senate, they should remember to be more moderate. Yes, that always sounds good to do things in moderation, but sometimes this is simply impossible for those who hold to standards with any degree of consistency. For example, if I believe abortion is murder and I want to be consistent with that position, how do I moderate that position? It does not mix with the notion that abortion is not murder. Should the abolitionists have been more moderate in their desire to see slavery end? Should they have worked with Southern Democrats in a bipartisan fashion? What would they have come up with? Some kind of new law that gives slaves extra benefits without actually granting them their freedom? Yeah, we have some good news and some bad news. The bad news is you're still a slave. The good news is we can offer you free health care. And every Sunday night, ice cream. I would also ask those who believe in a happy middle to define far right. The reason I challenge you this way is because the definition of far right is ever-changing. Most liberals, when they think of the far right, imagine some kind of fascist teaching. And yet it is the liberal who wants government to control every sector of our lives. That's where the fascism is. These days, those who believe in less government are viewed as far right. By that definition, our forefathers were far right because they wrote a constitution with extremely limited government. And 10 years ago, would you have believed the day would come when those who want to protect our own borders would be viewed as far right? All other countries believe in protecting their borders. Mexico arrests somebody and holds them in jail for 7 months, an American soldier, when he crosses the borders. Even the countries who chastise us for not caring about ours, they protect their borders. How about marriage? 10 years ago, most liberals, regardless of their view of gay marriage, would have laughed at the idea of calling somebody a fascist simply because he had the audacity to believe marriage should be defined as a union between a man and a woman. You see, as the left goes farther left, the real, genuine center looks farther right by comparison. For me, it is no longer a matter of right or left as ends in themselves. Neither do I accept the fact that centrists alone are the only wise and balanced individuals. Not if centrists are embracing the left's definition of what is too far right. One might ask where liberals got the authority to issue such classifications. After all, if we hold to the current definition offered by the left, centrists are no longer centrists. They are instead people who pat themselves on the back for being moderate, all the while failing to watch the undertow. They themselves are moving to the left, unawares. Gradual and unnoticed as the change in landscape may be, we should stop for a moment and look how far down the beach we have drifted. Chances are our towels and umbrellas are nowhere in sight. Human beings have disagreed with each other since the beginning of time. Now, I don't mind when people argue against my values or positions when they truly understand what they are objecting to. But serious debate is often paralyzed by emotional reaction to certain words and phrases. Nobody likes to be called names, and we all enjoy compliments, so we avoid these bad labels like landmines and turn praise into a trophy for our fireplace mantle. Still, without the courage to speak our minds, we make ourselves slaves to a language, forgetting that language was invented as a mere tool to convey ideas. Over time, some expressions have become so emotionally charged that their use ends discussion before wisdom can remind us that the expression actually means something. History provides us 20/20 hindsight, so undoubtedly the day will return when healthy discussion is valued above mere words. In the meantime, if we wanted to bury some of the most commonly misused words and phrases, I would be willing to recite a lovely eulogy. A lovely eulogy. And so, without further ado, I offer a list of words and phrases to permanently retire. Once the sandbags of this dam are removed, the free-flowing river of honest exchange and shared thought will return. The first phrase to retire: I find this offensive. Today's generation gets offended far too easily. Some would be offended if a leaf fell from a tree. Frankly, I don't care whether words offend. I care more about whether or not words are true. Our forefathers knew that free speech would often offend. Why else would it need to be protected by our Constitution? If it was always going to be benign, they wouldn't need to protect it. If it was never going to offend people, they wouldn't need to protect it. Certainly, there's no reason to purposely offend people as an end in itself. We should never go out of our way to be rude. Neither should those of us who are Christians and conservatives act self-righteously or be inappropriately judgmental. But when someone is offended simply by a manger scene, a cross around the neck, or an opposing political viewpoint, then we must face the fact that we live in very thin-skinned times, and we must stop worrying so much about what offends. The next word to retire, tolerance. "You sound intolerant," people cry in an effort to quickly silence their opponents and end all discussion. But the truth is nobody, and I mean nobody, and I'm talking to you listening to your radio, even you, nobody tolerates everything. Do you tolerate slavery? Do you tolerate racism? Do you tolerate rape? Do you tolerate murder? Okay, then each topic should be discussed on its own moral merits. When homosexuality comes up, the true subject hiding behind the word tolerance, the question should not be whether or not we tolerate the practice, but why we do or do not tolerate the practice. The next word to retire, hate. Yes, the slightest tone of concern, the sheer hint of warning, the mere audacity to disagree with anything politically correct is quickly labeled as hate. Not long ago, someone wrote to me claiming I had too much hate in my blog because I was so critical of Obama. Of course, this same person had been sending me conspiracy theories about George Bush for over a year before then. But we are getting ahead of ourselves and should back up for a moment. Hate is not necessarily a bad word. Some things in life are worth hating. I hate evil, for instance, and I hate evil without apology. The problem here, similar to the misuse of the word tolerance, is that we have disagreements about who is evil or what is evil. Admittedly, a more negative understanding of the word hate is the most prevalent today, namely an extreme bitter emotion that often wants to see harm done to others, even innocents. Unfortunately, today's culture has ripped all the power from this word. Once again, I'll throw this out. 20 years ago, could you have imagined the day would come when those who believe marriage should be between a man and a woman would be viewed as hateful, or that those who want to protect the life of an unborn baby would be known as vile meanies? No, we have not been good stewards of this word, and therefore it should be retired. More words to retire when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching of nationally famous speaker, Pastor Jim Garlow. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church. Sunday morning services at 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock a.m. Retired the word hate. We already retired the word tolerance. Let's retire the word compassion. So you think you are a compassionate person? Well, unless you want to give amnesty and free health care to illegal aliens, you are mistaken. Unless you want to forbid the death penalty to terrorists and other murderers, how dare you call yourself compassionate? Where do you get the nerve? Oh, yes, compassion toward unborn babies? That doesn't count. Or even born babies, for that matter, should you protest Obama's voting approval of infanticide in the Illinois Infant Protection Act. That also disqualifies you as a candidate for compassion, caring about that. Here's one I'd love to retire by. Partisanship. Being partisan simply means that you are partial to a certain point of view or political party that you believe in. How else would you have it? Should we instead show loyalty to the party whose values we disagree with? Oh, certainly there are always some issues important enough for Democrats and Republicans to work on together, but this would assume honest agreement on a matter that puts the good of the country before the good of the party. In other words, we might assume on the objective or agree on the objective, but have different points of view about how to get there. Unfortunately, today's definition of bipartisanship is that Republicans should do things the way Democrats want them done. Not getting behind President Obama is being partisan or unpatriotic, to name a couple of other words that should probably be retired. Of course, when George Bush was in office, Democrats lectured us about how American it is to offer healthy dissent. See, when they do it, it's healthy dissent. Speaking of the word American, let us move on to number six. Here's a phrase I want to retire, the American people. Now, I must admit, I don't want to eliminate real American people. I just want to eliminate this phrase. My emotion toward this phrase is very personal, and I may be alone in despising it, but honestly, the constant usage of these three words makes me want to throw up. They sound phony and disingenuous, whether they come from the lips of Democrats or Republicans. I am taking this stand because this is what the American people want to see. First of all, most politicians do not work for the American people. They do not give a rat's behind about the American people. They work for their own political parties and special interest groups. For another thing, our town hall meetings and tea parties are demonstrating that far too many of our trusted leaders don't have a clue what the American people really want and are not at all attuned to the heartthrob of the populace. Well, I offer a couple of objective reasons for deleting it. I should also confess that I'm just privately sick and tired of the phrase. I'll settle for anything else. Americans or American citizens or even just citizens. Hey, how about friends, Romans, countrymen? That has kind of a ring. But let us retire once and for all this patronizing phrase called the American people. And finally, let's get rid of the word diversity. As our own military involuntarily demonstrated not too long ago, the word not only hinders freedom, it ends lives. Specifically, the lives of 13 people gunned down at Fort Hood by Nidal Hassan, whose dangerous beliefs were clearly understood ahead of time by other officers because he was an officer. They nevertheless failed to mention anything for fear of being branded intolerant toward Muslims or politically incorrect. Asked about how such an individual could have remained in the Army after making some of his hate-filled open proclamations, General George W. Casey promised it was being looked into. He also went on to say that even if we lost our diversity of this incident, if we lost our diversity over this incident, it would be an even greater tragedy. Well, I disagree, General. I disagree. It seems to me that when someone is murdered in cold blood, that is the greater tragedy. These days, diversity does not refer to any true or honest diversity. If it did, I wouldn't mind the phrase. It means diversity of religion, or diversity of race, or diversity of sexual preference, or diversity of gender. It never, ever means diversity of ideas. If somebody holds a different view of homosexuality, or a different view of Islam, namely the view that Islam, despite the individual exceptions, just may not be the peaceful religion it claims to be. Such a viewpoint is not tolerated, even if the conclusion is backed up by science in the case of the former, or the Quran itself in the case of the latter. And so, my friends, because we have been irresponsible with this word, even to the point where it has become lethal, time now to also retire the word diversity. Of course, there are and will be many other words and phrases to retire, but seriously, wasn't my modest little offering a good start? Just imagine how much easier conversation, dialogue, and debate would go if the words on this list were quarantined. People would actually be forced to truly listen to each other, and that might be a whole new experience for both hands, the left and the right. Well, switching gears and getting into our Bible section, and I teased you a little bit with this at the top of the show. Often in the midst of debates or informal discussions with skeptics, I will defend the historicity of the Bible. I'm immediately given a very common, politically correct lecture. It goes something like this. History is written by the victors. In other words, countries whitewashed their own history to make themselves look good. And if they were the victors, then they are in a position to do that. And you never hear what the poor conquered people said. Okay, now that is sometimes true. It's sometimes true. We know, for example, that the ancient Egyptians did exactly that. They do not even mention a people with whom they experienced very difficult challenges, the Hyksos. We know about the Hyksos due to records from other cultures. Incidentally, this may explain why there is no record in ancient Egypt of Israel's deliverance. Nobody was going to write about an incident that gave their pharaoh a black eye and blemished Egypt in the eyes of other nations. Having said that, history is often more complex. Let's take another example from ancient history, this time looking at the Romans. We have records according to the official Roman version. We also have the Greek version, writers who lived under Roman suppression. We have the Jewish version, Jewish historians such as Josephus and Philo, who were able to tell us how their people enjoyed being conquered by Rome and paying taxes to Rome. We have the writings of the Christians, who were persecuted for centuries under the Romans. We have the writings of Roman cynics and satirists, like Seneca, for example, who were very critical of Rome. Face facts. One couldn't ask for a more comprehensive record of ancient Rome from the widest variety of opinions and perspectives. This leads us to a very interesting observation about the Bible, specifically the first part, which Christians call the Old Testament and Jews call the Tanakh. You could not possibly find a stronger indictment of ancient Israel than the words of the ancient Israelites themselves. They portray themselves as constantly disobeying God, breaking his covenant, and deserving of the lost battles when God punishes them by removing his restraining hand. Take a look at just one portion from the book of Judges. It says, "Then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger, so they forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtaroth. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who murdered them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies." Wow, that was from Judges chapter 2. Eventually, Israel repents and God delivers them. Then it happens again and again and again. It happens so much just in the book of Judges alone that theologians refer to this as the Judges cycle. Israel sins. God allows their enemies to subdue them. Israel repents. God raises up a deliverer like Deborah or Samson. Israel sins again. God allows their enemies to conquer again, and so on and forth. But it doesn't stop with the book of Judges. This pattern continues throughout Israel's history until it is finally conquered by the Assyrians and Babylonians.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. Bobsiegel.net.
History is written by the victors. Well, and how do you explain the Old Testament? The Old Testament wrote a very negative portrayal of Israel, portraying themselves as constantly disobeying God. One need only read prophets like Jeremiah. We were looking at Judges before, but look at Jeremiah and understand that such invasions like people like the Babylonians were allowed only because of Israel's disobedience. And who do we learn this from? Israel. Even after she's victorious, even after she wins some battles, even after she returned to the Promised Land after 70 years of Babylonian captivity, the words of her prophets who criticized her are canonized for all time. Whatever your view of history, one must admit that the writers of the Old Testament are showing remarkable integrity. This is yet another of many arguments for the accuracy of the Bible. Speaking of biblical integrity, let's take a look now at the New Testament. This is another of those subtle observations that people seldom catch. The Bible, coming out of a chauvinistic culture, is an area of major contention. Now, I've done whole shows on this. Actually, the Bible is not a chauvinistic collection of documents, but it does indeed come out of a male-dominated world. To the Romans, the Greeks, and the Jews, the three major cultures converging when the New Testament was written, women were viewed as little more than property. Interestingly enough, this makes the gospel accounts very noteworthy. If these writings were crafted by men who just wanted to deceive and influence their peers, then why do they write about Mary Magdalene as the first to encounter the resurrected Christ instead of one of the males? She met Jesus before the others. She also reported the meeting to Jesus' male disciples who at first did not believe her. In those days, reporting that a woman had been the first to witness the resurrection would not have been the shrewdest way to commit fraud and generate a legend. So why did they write the Gospels that way? Maybe because that's the way it really happened. Just a thought. Just another snapshot into the integrity of the Bible writers. Now, speaking of the Bible, there are many Christians today who believe we're living in the last days. And we're told a little bit in Bible prophecy that in the last days preceding the time of Christ, it'll be preceded by a seven-year tribulation. And during the 7 years, this man that's sometimes called the Antichrist, sometimes called the Son of Perdition, sometimes called the Evil One, the Lawless One, this person will come into power. And I hear Christians say, oh, maybe Barack Obama is the Antichrist. Okay, I'm no fan of Obama, but Obama is not the Antichrist, okay? He's not the Antichrist. I'll say this. Rather than trying to predict when the Antichrist and the Second Coming will arrive, I'd like to look at why the Antichrist will come into power. I'll say this, the way people were deceived by Obama, the hypnotic effect he had on them. It's very much like the way the Antichrist will come into power. It's not him. But I met a woman on the plane the day after the 2008 election. I was flying to Israel, and somebody was sitting next to me. She said she voted for Obama because she just got a good vibe from him. Then she told me she was a libertarian. I said, you're a libertarian? Do you realize that Obama's policies could not possibly be more the opposite of libertarian? They wouldn't possibly show up even on the same side of the page. But she got a good vibe. Now, we're told that not only will the Antichrist be somebody attractive, but he'll also be somebody who can do miracles. Now, normally, we say if somebody's doing a miracle, they have the power of God. That's true as a general rule. But sometimes the Bible allows for exceptions to the rule. God has an enemy named Satan. Now, I've done a whole show on Satan, but he is a spiritual being who fell from heaven, rebelled against God, works against God, and tries to deceive people and give them alternate religions to worship other than Christ. Now listen to this. I'm reading from 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 9 through 12. It says, the coming of the lawless one, they're talking here about the Antichrist, coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders, and in every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing. They perish because they refused to love the truth and so be saved. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so that they will believe the lie and so that all will be condemned who have not believed the truth but have delighted in wickedness. Wow, that is loaded. Now, sometimes people say, well, why did God allow them to be deceived? We're told right here, they had a chance to hear the truth. They rejected it. So it says in verse 11, for this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so that they will believe the lie. Now, you need to understand the way ancient Israelites wrote. They would write as if God caused everything, but what they meant is nothing can happen unless God allows it. We learn this very clearly in books like Chronicles and Job. When it says God sent them a delusion, they meant God allowed Satan to send them the delusion. Satan's the deceiver, but of course he couldn't do it if God didn't allow it. Well, why did God allow it? Because they had heard the truth, they had heard the gospel, and they had hardened their hearts. I'm going to tell you something, and this is going to surprise some of you. We're invited to go to God and make prayer requests, but if you pray about something that the Bible has already settled, for example, if you're having an adulterous affair and you read in the Bible that you shalt not commit adultery, one of the Ten Commandments, and you go to God in prayer and say, God, maybe in my case, adultery's all right. Maybe I'm a special case. Give me a sign that it's okay. If you ask God for permission to do something which the Bible has already condemned, did you know that Satan has permission to answer your prayer? You don't believe me? Well, we already read part of the answer right there. 2 Thessalonians, they heard the truth. They wanted to hear a lie. But here's from 1 Kings chapter 22, verses 19 through 23. This is when Israel had had a civil war, and they were divided into two kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel under the reign of King Ahab, the kingdom of Judah under the reign of King Jehoshaphat. And they wanted to attack Aram. That country back then included the Damascus, where we would today call Syria. And they were a bunch of false prophets of false gods, and 400 prophets had told them to have the battle. I'm reading 1 Kings 22, starting with verse 19. Micah the prophet was called, and he was the only prophet of God. So it was one guy's word, one true prophet against 400 false prophets. See, this idea that the majority has to be right, frequently throughout history, the majority was wrong. But anyway, Micah continued, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, with all the hosts of heaven standing around him on his right and on his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab into attacking Ramoth-Gilead and going to his death there? One suggested this and another that. Finally, a spirit came forward, stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. By what means? The Lord asked. I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouths of all his prophets, he said. You will succeed in enticing him, said the Lord. Go and do it. So now the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouths of all these prophets of yours. The Lord has decreed disaster for you. Now, of course, Micah's conveying a vision that he saw. And in a vision, we're seeing this picture to make a point. Once again, in reality, God didn't ask some spirit to be lying. It was just their way of conveying to Micah that one of Satan's spirits wanted to lie. And why was God allowing it? Because these guys should never have been going to false prophets in the first place. They were inquiring of the wrong gods. But even when you have the correct name for God, if you're telling yourself that you're a special case, you're a special person, God loves you in a special way, that's true. But if you're telling yourself that you're so special that what's a sin for others is not a sin for you, watch out. I knew a woman in college named Debbie. Now, Debbie saw the Bible's command to be baptized. There's a lot of different understanding of baptism. Maybe you're listening right now and you've never quite understood that. That's fine. God will always take sincere ignorance into account. But this wasn't true with Debbie. Debbie read, knew, was educated, was discipled, clearly understood the biblical command to be baptized. But she came out of a non-Christian family. And even though she was an adult, she would have given her right arm for the approval of her parents, which she had seldom gotten growing up. That's understandable. But not to the point where she's compromising. She did not want to get baptized because she knew her parents wouldn't like it. And so she said to me one day, I've decided not to get baptized, but I've got wonderful news, wonderful news. I went to God last night in prayer, and I said, God, if it's okay for me not to get baptized, then when I wake up tomorrow morning, I just pray that I'll feel a feeling of peace. She goes, and you know, Bob, I woke up the next morning, and I felt this feeling of peace. I said, Debbie, when the Bible commands us to be baptized, there isn't a little clause in parentheses that says, unless your name is Debbie. See, she was praying about something she had no business praying about because God already had commanded her. The good news is she did finally get baptized. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.